A long time ago, in a country far, far away, coffee beans were roasted, then slowly made their way to the brands you find at the grocery store. But no longer are you beholden to the beans that were roasted months ago, parsecs away, because now they're Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug Coffee is roasted in Toronto when you order and delivered anywhere in Canada within days, so you're always enjoying the freshest, highest quality coffee. Sparkplug offers roasts and grinds to suit any taste, and they make it easy for you by offering regular delivery. It's time for your favorite coffee to start coming from your own kitchen, so plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100
Project.
And action.
May the 2nd be with you, movie men and women, and thanks for checking out our podcast that reviews movies of all shapes and sizes, with or without Jedi in them. Fair warning, we won't hold anything back. We're going to ruin the secrets of this scarcely seen series. My name is Emperor Ryan Ellis, and this is my young apprentice. And she's my wife, Bev.
That's me.
So the coming attraction trip for this week's picture, The Empire Strikes Back. Of the 7 Star Wars movies, only one did not finish first at the U.S. box office. Which one was it?
It was Star Wars Episode 2, Attack of the Clones. It was 3rd. It didn't even come 2nd.
Mm-hmm. Spider-Man was number 1, and Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers was number 2.
And Lord of the Rings, Two Towers was another 2nd installment in a very high-profile trilogy.
Mm-hmm, and way better regarded
than
Attack of the Clones was, for sure.
Well, it was a low bar.
But the 2nd installment of the first trilogy, which of course is Episode 5, is probably the best regarded of all the Star Wars movies by most people.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the Next 100 Project's 16th motion picture, The Empire Strikes Back, which was an AFI nominee in both 1998 and 2007, but of course did not make it. After some premieres in Washington, D.C. and London, England, 20th Century Fox sicked Empire loose on May 21st, 1980. Despite going way over budget, the movie hauled in a mighty load of loot. But Beth, for those who don't know what the movie's about, explain it for them, please, right now.
Well, no movie fan hasn't seen this one yet, or doesn't at least know the plot of it. And if you haven't, get some cookies and a juicy juice, and maybe go back to Dora reruns.
Children. Child. Or, in a nutshell, Hallucination instructs ex-farmer to ask a puppet to teach him how to fight. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes critics on Empire. 94% of them liked the movie, 82 fresh, 5 rotten, 97% of audiences, and it's 12th on the IMDb's 250. Although, plenty of major critics at the time in 1980 did not rave about this movie, they've come around ever since. And we talked about the box office. It's 13th all-time on Box Office Mojo's Adjusted for Inflation list. The first Star Wars movie and The Force Awakens currently outrank it. The Force Awakens is not that far behind Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in reaching the top 10, but it isn't quite there yet. And, of course, Empire was number 1 in 1980. It made more than twice as much as 9 to 5 and Stir Crazy, which were also pretty big hits. Okay, so we're 2 days shy of May the 4th. Last year we happened to release Star Wars on May the 4th. But what are your thoughts on Empire Strikes Back, Bev?
I only saw this movie for the first time as a total full-grown adult in my 20s. When we watched it for this, it was only the 2nd time I saw it. So I'm really not super qualified to speak on it, considering how much of a cultural juggernaut it was and how much I kind of missed out on a lot of that. But I liked it better the 2nd time around. I definitely like it better than Star Wars, than A New Hope.
A lot of people do, including me.
Yeah, I think the more I see it, the more I'm coming around to it. I think it's probably time for me to watch it at least once without anybody else with me, especially not somebody else who's seen the movie thousands of times and is a super fan.
Was I that bad?
You're not that bad. It all comes from passion and enthusiasm. But it's just like a surreal experience to just be trying to actually follow the plot of a film and have someone with you who's pointing out little details that aren't really significant to me. You're far less annoying than the first person I watched this movie with, let's put it that way.
Yeah! Okay, we covered the first Star Wars last year, so we don't have to go over every little bit and every little detail and the politics of it and how Lucas struggled to get the movie made, because he struggled to get this one made too. I do have a fun little segment we'll do called Reasonably Good Questions. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But let's go over the genesis of the project in more of a compact way here. It was called Episode 5, but the first movie was not Episode 4. If somebody argues that it was when it first came out, it was not. It was just Star Wars, then The Crawl, and then the movie went on from that point. When they knew they were going to make this movie, that's when Star Wars New Hope was given that title. So the re-release before this one came out is what changed that first movie. I've only seen the prequels and Force Awakens on the big screen. I've never seen the first three on the big screen, so my nerd status has been revoked a little bit.
I'll alert the authorities.
Put me in nerd jail where I belong. So you say you like this movie more than you thought you would. I always like this movie plenty. I'm definitely one of those people that says it's better than the first one, but you need to see the first one to understand this one. This one's richer than the first one, and one of the things that's so much better, as people have pointed out for 36 years, because they've got a director with more humanity maybe behind him. George Lucas, infamously in the first movie, did not want to really direct people. It was his whole thing. His directions were faster, more intense. Well, Erwin Kirschner, who was Lucas's USC teacher, was recruited to do this one. He hasn't really done anything significant since. You think a guy who directed The Empire Strikes Back would get project after project, and maybe he got offers and just didn't do them. He did do Never Say Never Again, the non-Bond slash actual Bond movie with Connery, and then RoboCop 2 in the early 90s, but really not much else in his resume beyond that. But he brought spontaneity and humanity to the characters, and he made a believable love story between Han and Leia also. But curiously, when you think about Luke, Leia, and Han, three of the most iconic characters in the history of film, the first one doesn't have the three of them working together that much, but it's a decent chunk of the movie from the middle towards the end. This one barely has them together at all. In fact, it goes against the idea of the trio of young stars sharing screen time because they don't really. Mark Hamill mostly acts against puppets, hallucinations, like I said, Alec Guinness as a special effect, and stuntmen portraying Darth Vader.
Well, Leia and Han spend plenty of time together in the Millennium Falcon.
With Chewie and 3PO, yeah, but not with Luke and R2. So they're all separated off.
Yeah.
But the movie's not really about the actors anyway, even though they are better than they were in the first movie. Or probably, I guess, the third movie, and then certainly than the actors were in the prequels. But these movies are known, of course, for things like the effects. And here you've got, again, kind of like you did in the first movie, but way more so in some major sequences like the AT-AT walkers, stop motion. This kind of stuff still, maybe doesn't stand up exactly in 2016, but it has that authenticity, that reality to it.
It's still believable enough that it's not distracting or phony. We covered the Ten Commandments recently, and we talked about how some effects stand up just because you don't notice them, or they don't stand out as stupid looking, where there are other effects, like the animated staffs turning into snakes, that just look so silly that it's embarrassing. You would not say that about anything in the Star Wars universe at all. Most of those effects actually stand up really well.
And what Lucas and Kirschner did also in this film was take us to so many different worlds. We saw that in the first movie, and we've seen that in all the movies. The prequels actually probably show the most diversity when it comes to the different worlds you see. But here you've got the ice planet on Hoth, then the jungle planet of Dagobah, the cloud city of Bespin, which is more spacey than the rest of them, I guess. We don't see Tatooine. The only movie in the series so far, Force Awakens doesn't have Tatooine, but it does have a desert planet in the beginning.
Yeah.
So the only non-desert movie in all the seven so far is this one. They do mention it at the end, but we never see Tatooine.
It's also the only movie of the three and Force Awakens 2 that doesn't have the Death Star.
Maybe that's one of the reasons why this movie stands out to people, too, in retrospect, those who have seen it over and over again and think it does kind of stand on its own. Yes, you need the first movie and the third movie, fourth and sixth, to understand where this whole thing's going. But as a standalone, it's pretty great. I remember some reviewers said about The Two Towers. You said this movie was out the same year. Of course it was, 2002. Oh, sorry, not this movie, but Attack of the Clones. Sorry, getting back to our trivia question at the beginning. And I remember the Salon reviewer said it has typical second act problems or second movie of a trilogy problems. If you just watched that and didn't know anything, you'd be lost beyond belief. Who are these people? Where are they going? But The Two Towers has some great stuff in it. The infamous Battle of Helm's Deep, the Gollum stuff. There's some excellent things in there. So does it stand on its own? No, and on the IMDb, I mentioned that Empire Strikes Back is 12th. Two Towers is the lowest ranked of the three Lord of the Rings movies, but it's still really highly ranked on the IMDb 250 and still was a huge hit. So if the visual effects do hold up, and we say they do, curiously, maybe not curiously actually, because we just said they work, this has the fewest tinkers of any of Lucas's redos from the original series.
Oh yeah, it does.
Return of the Jedi doesn't have that much, I guess, more at the end when he wants to redo the music that the Ewoks sing, and of course they show all the planets celebrating the Empire going down. The first movie has a ton of things change, and we know what those are from the other podcasts, and people who know this movie know that anyway.
And outraged nerds everywhere.
But they didn't really change plot points or major scenes like they did in those other two movies. In this one, it's just minor tinkers, maybe because Lucas knew he got it right, and Kirschner, too, directing it, got it right. Let's do those reasonably good questions right now. So here we go. If you have an answer for these, then great. And if you don't, then so be it.
Okay.
First question. Who's funding the Rebels? They have a lot of expensive equipment. Who is paying for all this stuff?
Well, who knows how the economy works in this galaxy far, far away? Because it's not just the rebels that are getting funded. If you look at what the Empire is building, you're talking about things that take a massive amount of resources. I guess you could argue that there's plenty of wealthy individuals that support the rebels?
Private enterprise.
Yeah.
Republicans, I guess, then. They take care of each other.
Well, maybe they're just drug dealers or... Or, you know, maybe the rebels are supported by planet states that collect taxes for it. Come on, God, this is such a square question.
I've never heard anyone ask that before. That's how are these people paying for all these spaceships and space stations and remote bases? And as soon as something bad happens, they just split. Well, we better start the evacuation. And you should, but how do you afford to go to another place so easily and so quickly?
And of all the galaxy, you chose a winter planet, you fools? We're Canadian. We know better.
I read that was Lucas wanting to challenge the effects department because hiding the matte lines in space was a lot easier because of black than it is when you do it with white.
Oh, what a dick. He just put his special effects team through hell.
But the stop motion and the tauntauns and the visual effects with the winter speeder things they have... I didn't see any matte lines or anything like that. Maybe they improved them since the original releases.
I figured they would have won the special effects award for the abominable snowman. The man dressed in a white ape suit who hung Luke upside down.
That was not in the original cut, I heard. And as I pointed out to you when we saw the movie, the thing wants to eat him later. Okay, fine. Maybe it dragged the Tauntaun back, although he doesn't seem to be dragging the Tauntaun back when it kills Luke. But why does it hang him upside down and does it just hold him there for a while? His feet are freezing very slowly. I still have to hold him. He's still not frozen. What time is it? Okay, still gonna hold him.
He's a dumb beast. He thought to melt the ice and then freeze it again and then hold him still for what had to be, honestly, I don't care how cold it is out there, that takes like 20 to 30 minutes to freeze solid enough to hold him upside down like
that.
What
else does he have to do? He's just gonna eat Luke when he gets the chance to, although the Tauntaun's got a lot more meat on him. He should have dragged the Tauntaun back and eaten him. Alright, second reasonably good question. Did Obi-Wan never appear in a vision before Luke's near death on Hoth? And this has been about 2 years since Obi-Wan joined the Force at the end of A New Hope. So never once, you must go to the Dagobah system, when Luke was just sitting around in one of the camps.
Yeah, good point. Why does he choose the moment he's almost dead? He could have warned him at some point when he was perfectly healthy and could have hopped in a spaceship and gone there far easier.
When he has way more important things to do than fight with the rebels on this little planet. As important as that was, this guy's got bigger fish to fry. All right, question number 3. What would have happened in the Dagobah cave had Luke not taken his lightsaber and his gun with him? Your weapons! You will not need them! But he takes them anyway.
Does he really?
Of course, he meets the vision of Darth Vader, which when he cuts off the face, it's his own face. Dun, 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 dun. Which is a good lead into the famous twist ending. But had he not taken his weapons in when Yoda tells him not to, what would have happened? Would he have still seen Vader and he had to come up with some other way to beat him? Or would it just be nothing? We just walk around and, oh, there's a lot of snakes and lizards in here, and what a waste of time that was.
Isn't the whole thing just a hallucination anyway?
Well, of course, there's no actual Vader there.
That's why he could have hallucinated his weapons, I suppose. That's actually what I thought happened. I thought he left his weapons.
No, because Yoda says don't take them, and you see him strap them on anyway.
That's interesting, because the whole point is that he should face his demons without hate and violence.
That's the point, of course, yeah. All right, another one. Is there artificial gravity in the Millennium Falcon with all the twisty moves Han Solo makes?
I know.
When they're on that worm thing in the middle of the rock in space, and then it moves, they shake, and then, of course, he catches Leia. Let me go! And they have that little fight. So, obviously, the Falcon can be shaken to the point where they do fall around. But when they're doing twisty moves in space, they never once do anything. There's no seatbelts in there, so it doesn't have artificial gravity. Who can say?
That's one special effect they hadn't begun to master. That is a tough special effect that adds a logistical nightmare to any production. Just ask Christopher Nolan.
All right, another one. And this has been asked by a lot of people long before me. But how did Vader beat Han and Leia, and Chewie and 3PO, to Bespin when Boba Fett was tracking them there? They arrived right before you did. But how?
Because Han doesn't have a hyperdrive. So... Boba Fett is following them. He knows their trajectory. They put it together where they're going, and then Vader with a hyperdrive beats them there. Okay. I think they cut out a scene where the whole gang spends 3 months in space traveling to Cloud City because that's the only explanation for how that is going on at the same time as Luke is training with Yoda.
That was the next question because, this again, it's been asked by other people long before I'm asking it now. But what is the timeline? Luke trains for how long exactly to become that close to being a Jedi, and Han and Leia and friends, seems like they have a very short period of time before they end up where they do, so what makes sense there? But I do have a theory on this one.
All right.
I've never heard this said by anybody before, so maybe it's breaking news here on the Top 100 Project / Next 100 Project. Remember in Interstellar, they say that when you're on a planet that the gravity's different and it makes people age more, and when those guys get back to the ship with their friend still there, he's aged decades, and for them it's only been a matter of hours. Maybe that's it. Gravity on Dagobah affected things differently than it did for Luke, although nobody looks older, so that doesn't really hold up with that. But
well,
maybe you could say it's just months rather just than months, it be years or decades for them.
Sure. Okay. That's why they have gravity. You never see it, but there's like a spinning device just like an Interstellar.
I think the last couple questions especially I've asked you could be answered by the old Hitchcock thing.
Oh, yeah.
And you know what that is. For those who don't know this podcast very well, otherwise there'd be no movie.
Well, we also say all the time, you know, every single film has plot holes in it. And if the movie is good enough, you either don't notice or you don't care. And I think this is definitely a case of who cares?
Except like, for now in a podcast when you're supposed to care because it's fun. My last reasonably good question, and again, this has been said by other people, but I repeat it right now. Family Guy brought this up. Why did Lando raid Han's suitcase on the Falcon? Because at the end, he's wearing Han's clothes.
I didn't notice that. He's wearing Han's clothes?
Very similar, at least. It isn't exactly the same as Han's clothes, but very similar style. And at the end, when he's on the Falcon with Chewie, they're about to go off the Tatooine, and Luke is getting his new hand.
Maybe it's just what was in fashion at the time.
He's wearing nothing.
Space robes.
But he's wearing nothing like that before. He's got that cape when he's on Best Buddy. He's tired of wearing a cape. No capes!
Who gets tired of wearing a cape? Not Darth Vader.
That's true. How
silly he looks. It just gives you the opportunity to swiftly turn around and have a really dramatic whoosh.
I don't think Vader ever does that. Lando does at one point when he gets his little fight with Han, and then Han knocks the cape off. He puts it back on, a bit of a flourish, but yeah, Vader never really does flourishes. Anyway, that was it for my reasonably good questions.
Those were reasonably good.
Thank you. I didn't say they were going to be actually good questions, just almost good questions.
Pretty adequate.
All right, we just said Han. Let's stick with that and get away from the reasonably good stuff. I like that Han runs away from the Empire through this whole movie. He does it straight up fight them. Because he knows he can't beat those giant starships, and he maybe doesn't realize it, but he's going against Vader, of all people, that enormous starship, the Imperial Star Destroyer, that Vader has in the first movie, of course. It's one of the first things we ever see in this series, and it's a big part of this movie until it finally gets destroyed in Return of the Jedi. It's like Texas compared to Rhode Island, how much bigger it is than the other Star Destroyers, which in their own right could wipe out the Millennium Falcon just if it went head-to-head.
But he can never manage to pull himself away because he's in love.
But he needs to get his love out of there and away from the bad guys.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I thought you meant that he was trying to run to pay off his debt with Jabba the Hutt.
Oh, that's true. The beginning of the movie, maybe that's why he's not actually getting out of there. But he is trying to. You could argue he's going to go back and find Leia after he pays up the debt, had he actually done that. But he never gets that far.
Yeah, the rebels at the beginning of this movie are beaten and humiliated.
Well, this movie is The Empire Kicks Ass, actually.
Yeah.
Actually strikes back.
That's true.
I mean, Vader's just wiping out important military leader after important military leader, one after another in this film. Apology accepted. Well, with that love story, which we seem to agree is pretty well done by Carrie Fisher and Harrison Ford, Ford was in 5 AFI movies. Of course, the first Star Wars was one of those. So many huge hits in his career beyond those movies and the Star Wars series. And it's well known that when she says, I love you, and he says, I know, that was improvised.
I think that scene's incredible, and I think that exchange is absolutely amazing and deserves all the praise it gets. I don't love their love story. I don't find it very convincing. I find it trite and cliche and uneven because she hates him, she loves him. She's annoying. Like, she's actually awful for the first half of this movie. She comes around, but she's just harpy and mean. I don't get that they have any chemistry at all for the first half of the film.
I think they have chemistry working against itself, much like one of your favorites, When Harry Met Sally. That's better chemistry in a rom-com kind of way, obviously. Better actors.
Yeah, better writing, better acting. Yeah.
Movie, at least. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the same idea. You have to have conflict to come back together again. And next week's movie will cover that in a big way.
Well, that's just it. Next week's movie is an old film because this is an old concept that had been done very well many times before. I think that they were copying that notion and didn't pull it off. Maybe this is just me coming to it as an adult instead of a kid taking it at face value and seeing it as one of the early examples of that kind of love story, where I'm coming to it as a person who's seen this exact kind of plot get played out in many, many movies, and better in many, many movies. So to see this awkward dialogue get played out in these awkwardly blocked scenes, too. They're physically close, and they hate each other, love each other. This didn't work for me.
But in these kinds of movies, you think that's a problem? Because the love story is not the primary
source of anything. I'm just arguing that I don't think the love story is done as well as you think it is. I agree that the ending is great, the I Love You, I Know, but that's the only really good moment to me in that love story.
Well, I'm not saying it ranks up there with the great love stories of all time.
She even keeps kissing Luke, even though we're supposed to be rooting for her relationship with Han, and when they wrote the script, they knew they were brother and sister!
I don't think they knew that during the writing of the screenplay. That whole thing, another famous thing from The Empire Strikes Back, is Vader is Luke's father. Came up later on, and very few people even knew that was going to be the twist. So that shocked everybody, including people who made the movie. Supposedly, David Prowse said on set, "Obi-Wan is your father." And Luke's reaction isn't quite as relevant when he thinks that. But the whole, "No, that's not true, that's impossible!" Thinking that the guy I'm facing right now killed my father, who I never knew was my father, and I watched him die at your hands, that's okay. But the whole twist of it being that, no, I'm your father. But then, the bigger part of that, really, is that Obi-Wan and Yoda are enormous jerks for not telling Luke the truth, especially when he insisted on going. Because in the next movie, the whole point is once you know that Vader's your father and then you face him, then you're a Jedi. Well, okay, if he insists on going to help his friends, which is a pretty noble thing to do, if they just said, "Luke, okay, wait a second, okay, sit down for a minute. You don't have to stay for hours, just give us 10 minutes. When you go face this guy, he's your dad. And one of the people you want to save, she's your sister. Now think about this for a second," rather than, "No, just let him go off." And of course, it's a great twist. Again, the Hitchcock thing, you have to have that for the drama. And it is one of the great twists of all time, for sure.
And up there was Psycho,
Citizen Kane. Yes, exactly. But that doesn't change the fact that we've compared already Lord of the Rings. The elves in Lord of the Rings are jerks, and Yoda and Obi-Wan in this series are also big jerks.
But they have to be jerks so that he can become a proper Jedi?
Well, I guess not knowing the truth about this makes... I don't know. I don't think that's really fair. But again, we're armchair quarterback movie that's been out for 36 years.
Yeah, we're nitpicking a movie that obviously is beloved. And
we should be, because that's our job. So back to the story. I'm getting into the Luke and Vader confrontation on Bespin, or at least in Cloud City. There's a great use of angles and different camera lenses to make Luke look tiny. And of course, Mark Hamill's already pretty short compared to Vader. And both the stuntman and David Prowse, who really doesn't do much Vadering in that fight scene because he wasn't actually a stuntman. So the stuntman, Bob Anderson, I think his name is, he's the one who was mostly in the suit at that point in the movie. This is a better lightsaber duel than what Obi-Wan and Vader had in the first movie, by far.
Mm-hmm.
The third movie is okay, but then Luke keeps on stopping the fight because he doesn't want to fight his father. And at the end, when he goes mad and, you know, "I'll turn Leia instead of you," then Luke just beats the living crap out of Vader and cuts his hand off. We can't compare it to the prequels because they have visual effects they can use. And that's the thing I think that stands out the most in all the Star Wars movies that doesn't work. When you have the effects we talked about, the stop motion, and just the way they did effects back in the 80s. What stands out in a bad way is when the Jedi can jump 50 feet.
Yeah.
Because no one ever does this. Now, you could argue, and I think Lucas has, that it's old men, one of them is a bionic man, and a kid who isn't really fully trained yet. But still, that they can do all those kinds of things. And the lightsaber fight in the third movie especially, when Obi-Wan and Anakin face off in Revenge of the Sith, is tremendous. It's one of the best sword fights in the history of movies. This is the best sword fight in the first three movies. Do you agree?
Yeah, I don't really like the fighting scenes in the prequels. Now, mind you, I haven't seen them since they came out, but I remember finding them cartoonish, like watching a video game, that there was something just often dull about them. There was a phoniness about them, and I didn't feel that about Empire. Also, by the time we get to the lightsaber fight, I'm so fully invested, which is not true of the prequels. I never really emotionally got into those films, and yet this one is paced so well, and the characters actually develop in Empire far more than they do in the first film, and probably in any of the films, with the exception maybe of The Force Awakens, which I loved. But it's not just that, it's that they practically had to perform the sword fight. It wasn't all animated after the fact, it wasn't done in green screen sets, and they really had to learn the moves. That just really makes for a better film. I think most people agree that modern special effects have kind of spoiled action films.
I remember that Roger Ebert said about the big fight I just mentioned between Obi-Wan and Anakin when they're at their peak in Revenge of the Sith. They do the force move on each other with their hands, and of course they're using the lightsaber a lot of the time too, and flipping and flopping. And in the end, it just becomes, for most of it at least, this I'm as good as you are kind of battle. So in the end, what really is the point? Well, I guess there's a point, and Obi-Wan does beat him. He gets the high ground, then cuts his arms and legs off. But before that even happens, they're so evenly matched. I guess we have the underdog thing. Rocky, you know, that wasn't that many years. Well, 1 year before the first movie came out, Rocky should have no business staying with the champ, but he does anyway. In this movie, here's Rocky. Luke has no business staying with the champ, Darth Vader, and yet he manages to do it well enough until he loses his hand.
But what really makes Empire stand out, and what makes it one of the best Star Wars movies, if not the best Star Wars movie, is that Luke should not have gone and helped his friends. They actually looked after themselves and they were fine. All he did was pick a fight with somebody that he was never going to win. He wasn't ready to face up to Vader. He should have stayed with Yoda and continued his training and truly gotten ready for the fight ahead. But he made a mistake, and so he failed, like all of our heroes fail.
That's a good point. It doesn't stop Han from getting taken away. And then Lando, Chewie, Leia, 3PO, and R2...
they rescue him!
They could have... Yeah, exactly. That's very true. They could have gone after Han themselves. Of course, Luke does make the plan in the third movie, or the sixth movie, to get him. But as far as actually saving them, he doesn't save Leia, Chewie, and the robots, and then the guy doesn't even know, Lando. They save themselves, you're right, yeah. And Han is encased in carbonite. He doesn't do anything about that.
So that's the difference between this and Rocky, and that's part of what makes Empire darker. It makes it more interesting, makes it unique, and the best.
The Jedi in all the movies, all seven of them, have often made bad decisions. And that's one of the great things about it, too. They're supposed to be these monks who are logical. Even if they are a member of the Sith, they still have some kind of logic.
Yeah, they're
just on the dark side of it.
There's like a defining Jedi thing.
And yet they often make mistakes. Okay, the Force. That's given more credence in this movie than it was in the first one. The first one obviously mentions it and has a big part of the movie. But in this one, you've got Yoda explaining a little better. It still doesn't need to be explained. I mean, when they do the midichlorians, and people have ripped on that forever, I'm not going to spend any time on that right now. Of course, we don't think that's good either.
There's like a cottage industry
right. That's
built up around making fun of midichlorians.
But Yoda's saying in this movie about how it does all these things. It binds us together, the tree and the rock and you. That's enough. It's getting even more in-depth than it did in the first movie when Obi-Wan first mentioned it to Luke. I like that idea. It's more of what the natives would think.
Or Buddhists.
We all are, yeah. We're all tied in together. Not just humans, even. Not just different races or different cultures, which is a deep enough concept for a lot of people out there. I'd want to believe that, oh, I could possibly have something in common with somebody who lives in the inner city, which they should. But we're actually tied together in this room with our dogs, with the table, the couch, which is very mystical. I don't know if I actually agree with that, but it's a nice thought.
Are you saying our couch is mystical?
I've had it a long time, so maybe it's pretty mystical. Okay, so the Yoda and Luke training. Here you've got a character, not an actor, although Frank Oz does a great job with that puppet. And Lucas tried to get an Oscar nomination, which was rejected. Andy Serkis has been through that many times, mm-hmm. too, doing a visual effect, so it's not him on screen.
Again, in the Two Towers, that was mm-hmm. Andy Serkis.
One of the better dialogue exchanges in the whole film is when Yoda raises the ship out of the mud, and at the end, Lucas, I don't believe it. That is why you fail.
Mm-hmm.
I like that notion, because I remember when I was in high school, I did a project in gym, and we actually got into theory in gym class. It wasn't just about running around and throwing balls and doing that kind of stuff. About positive thinking. I haven't always maintained it in my life, but just the logic of sitting there or standing there during a game, before a game, visualizing what you're going to do. But I think what Yoda's trying to say there simply is that if you have more faith and more confidence in this idea of yourself and of the Force, and if you're bound with everything around you, you can raise the ship out of the water too. And maybe we'll see that in these next movies. There's that great meme online where Rey from The Force Awakens has Luke on her back, just like Yoda's on Luke's back and Empire Strikes Back. And maybe he's gotten to be that powerful a Jedi that he can do things like raise ships out of water and way more, in fact.
Too bad he wasn't there when Poe's ship sunk into the dune and Finn was left there staring at it. They could have used a Jedi to lift it up.
Somehow Poe survived and took his jacket off in the process. So back to the big confrontation at the end when Vader reveals his actual parentage. This question's been asked before many times through the whole series, the first movie and big part of this one. Why doesn't Vader recognize the last name of Skywalker? Could have put that in the reasonably good questions thing because, of course, he should recognize it. But one of the things in the prequels that really does aid the previous movies and ties them together pretty well is the Emperor does tell Vader that Padme, his wife, has died. So he has no reason to think there is a Luke or a Leia or anybody else.
So he wasn't looking for them that whole
right.
time.
Right. We could have an Ellis out there, but we don't know that we're supposed to have an Ellis out there. You can make that logic then. Why are we looking
for... I would know if I gave birth to
well, you would
child.
Know. Yeah, okay. For me, then. I'm not looking for a young Ellis because there's no reason for me to think that there's a young Ellis out there.
So I actually assume that Vader always knew in all the movies that Luke was his son and Leia was his daughter.
He does play that off in this movie, granted, but then they have that conversation, the only time we see the Emperor in this film, And it was redone. They had a different actor play him in the original. We found this on YouTube. I'll try to find that link to put on the website, where Clive Revel, I think this is how his name is said, does the Emperor. But, of course, they put Ian McDiarmid in this version. He obviously knows the whole time. Of course, the Emperor also has the sight beyond sight kind of stuff to know this anyway. I think the movie puts it out there that he does know, but I'm just saying, you could argue that Vader doesn't know for sure who Luke is. However, here's something else Lucas has said in the commentary track. I like this. I think I mentioned this on the Star Wars podcast we did a few months ago. That in this scene, when Vader's trying to tempt him, it's kind of the devil and Jesus thing. When Jesus is out in the desert, yeah. The devil's tempting him. Just do this thing. Be my servant. You can have all of humanity. You can have the whole world, Jesus. Well, same kind of idea. Join me and we can rule the galaxy together.
And in both cases, you're asking somebody to give in to a really natural impulse to get angry.
And in neither case, it's either the devil or Vader saying, we're going to kill people and do bad things. It's just, let's run this together. They're not actually saying we're going to hurt people, although in both cases, they probably would. But here's what Lucas says about that scene, that the logic of it is, Vader wants Luke to join him so together they can overthrow the Emperor. So then Vader's the new Emperor, and then Luke is the new Vader. And of course, the Emperor wants Luke so he can wipe out Vader, and that's the new Vader. And then Luke wants them both dead because they're both bad guys. So you've got this threesome working against each other, all with the logic of one of you, if not two of you, have to die for this thing to work out for the betterment. Because let's not forget that even on the dark side, they think they're doing the right thing.
Just fighting over the power of Luke. Luke.
Marsha. So, of course, what happened to the lightsaber when Luke loses it? Well, we know Maz Kanata got it. But I think this is going to be a huge point in the next bunch of movies. How did she get it? And as far as the family goes, Leia starts using the Force without even knowing she has the Force, because she finds out Luke is her brother and Vader's her father in the next film. But she does sense him when he's on that weather vane. She comes back to save him. And then just after that, one of my favorite hero moments in the history of movies is when R2 saves the day by fixing the hyperdrive. You did it! Because they're dead otherwise. Well, not dead, of course. Vader's going to just pull him into his tractor beam and have all of them, but he saves the day.
Doesn't R2 save the day at some point in every one of the films?
In the prequels, he's a big-time savior as well. Probably the real hero of this entire series.
R2.
So we've talked about Hamill, Fisher, and Ford for the most part. Oh, one thing about Ford I gotta say. He's right. Han should have died in the third movie in Return of the Jedi. That's what he wanted to happen, to become a true hero and to complete that arc. I can say this now. It is May. Han Solo finally dies in The Force Awakens. He isn't actually saving anybody. He's not actually sacrificing himself for his friends, per se.
Well, he's trying to turn Kylo Ren around. Mm-hmm. He's trying to do good.
But Ford wanted to die in Return of the Jedi to save everybody. Instead, you get kind of a Lord of the Rings thing, where almost everyone we ever cared about on the good side survives. In fact, I guess in the Star Wars movies, everybody does, except for Obi-Wan in the very first one. But even he's part of things by being a blue Force ghost, so even he has a relevance thing here. The Fellowship actually loses more members. They lose two, one of those being Gandalf, who's kind of alive and not really alive. Anyway. Billy Dee Williams, the rare black guy in the galaxy, at least in the original movies, and of course we know that Carrie Fisher is the only woman who really matters, apart from Mon Mothma in the original movies.
She's the only woman in the galaxy. There's so many men.
They're finally making up for that, though, in these new movies, including Rogue One, which comes out this December, because the main character is a woman, and then Mon Mothma's back. I don't think it's the same actress. It must be a different... Gotta be. Oh, yeah, that woman would be 30-plus years older, so it can't be her. But she looks like she's got a major part of the film, too. And then a black guy, Forrest Whitaker, seems to have a pretty big role in it as well.
And they are managing to prove the Hollywood notion wrong that you need a white male protagonist to get butts in the seats. Certainly not proven to be true.
People have speculated that maybe Poe and Finn are gay also. And I don't think they're going to go there. I think it's very possible, though. Mark Hamill said with Luke, I don't know, maybe he's gay. I don't think he put it that way. But he implied that he doesn't really have sexuality the way you might think he does. Why does he have to be hetero? I think is what Hamill's implying. Maybe he's just a monk kind of idea. Maybe Luke knew all along, if I have progeny, they could be like Vader's kids, could be turned to the wrong way. But he's also put it out there that maybe he's gay. And then maybe these two main characters, or two of the main three characters in this new series, also are.
I highly support the Poe Finn shippers.
If they're ever going to do something like that in a big franchise, why not Star Wars? Because it's going to succeed anyway.
Yeah, they've already been pushing boundaries, and not only have people still gone to the movies, but people love it. People actively, vocally are grateful they have finally broken the mold.
Well, I say as it's going to succeed anyway, as if there's a problem to have gay characters or lesbian characters. I don't think that's the case, but then a lot of people out there, of course, do. But I'm saying if you're going to do that, go with the New York Yankees kind of thing. put your lesser player on this great team, and then it's going to work anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's not a lesser angle. I know that. I'm just saying that it is subversive, especially
in a blockbuster. You're going to win no matter what you do, so go ahead and take that player off the bench. Mm-hmm. That deserves some time.
Right.
If I may do a sports analogy, which I never do because I don't understand most of
them. Good enough. But back to Empire Strikes Back and back to Lando Calrissian, Billy Dee Williams. Sure, it's got to be the black guy who betrays them. This is back, though, in 1980, and maybe now it would be the white guy.
And he becomes a hero, too, and Han betrayed them. Not betrayed them, but abandoned them in the first film. He's kind of like Han.
That's true. Empire. In the span of a short part of the movie, actually. It might be hours or days in both cases where they have their arc and they go from being, as Lucas liked to say in the commentary, a more compassionate person. What about Yoda? One of the more famous characters in the entire series, actually, despite the fact he's not in the first three movies that much. He's barely in the third one. He's not even mentioned in the first one. And he's in maybe a third of this one, if even that much. He's got the syntax thing. He's a little too cryptic with Luke. But what do you think of the character and the way he's portrayed?
I've never been the biggest Yoda fan. I've never really understood his popularity so much. I guess he's cute. Again, I wasn't a kid when I was first exposed to Yoda, so I don't know. I don't even feel like I'm qualified to opine on that. But I've discovered a neat little detail when I was doing my research, which is that his face was modeled after Einstein a little to make him smart. This is a very smart individual.
At the end of Return of the Jedi, he's 900 years old, he says, so he's had an awful lot of years to become smarter.
You know what? Something just occurred to me. I think I know why I don't love him as a character, is because the syntax, the voice, everything about him that's so characterized has given way too many people the opportunity to annoy me with impression after impression. It's like Austin Powers. It may have been charming once upon a time, but it's just been repeated back to me amateurishly by one too many people. Touché.
I want to just do the laugh and make it shorthand. And of course you go to Alec Guinness in his brief role. Tony Daniels as 3PO, Kenny Baker as R2, Peter Mayhew as Chewbacca, Ian McDiarmid, Boba Fett in his flying iron.
Hello.
Probably the most overrated henchman in the history of movies. I think I said this on the first Star Wars podcast. But here he is. We didn't see him in that first movie. Now he's in this one. And Vader is contracted out like a mob boss. What do you think of Boba Fett?
The popularity of Boba Fett has been a far bigger mystery to me than the popularity of Yoda, but I was thinking about him when we were watching the film. Maybe it's because he is the only character who's a villain, kind of independent from the Empire. He's just a contractor. The Empire throws all its resources at finding the rebels, whereas Boba Fett doesn't really have those resources. He just has his wits, and he catches on to what they would have done, probably because he's like them, and he probably thinks, what would I do? I would just get thrown out with the trash. It's just the only detail we ever learn about his character. There's so little to go on, so part of it could just be everybody is imposing their own idea of what they want him to be as a character. He's really vague. You never see his face. He speaks very little. You just know that he's very clever and kind of an outsider.
Yeah, he is the counterpoint to Han Solo, who also doesn't play by the rules, at least for a big chunk of the movies. I guess in this one, he's sort of now in the Rebellion, but not really fully until Return of the Jedi, when he is a full-on general. And Han, in the third movie, seems to know him. When Chewbacca says, we don't understand it, but he says Boba Fett, and then Han, Boba Fett! Boba Fett! It's not like that name means nothing to him. It's all about, oh my god, I'm going to take that guy out, but then he accidentally kills him. And that's one reason why I think the character's overrated. What a stupid way for him to die.
They probably just didn't realize what an iconic character he would become. Was it the Sarlacc pit that he just kind of falls in? They tried to make up for it with the prequels and perhaps laid it on a little too thick.
They're going to have another spin-off movie because they're doing a ton of spin-offs, and that'll be one of them. They're talking about doing a Han Solo prequel, Rogue One, this year. The Boba Fett movie, I think they're doing one. I don't know when it's going to come out. And I don't know if they need to do that because the prequels may have ruined that whole logic in the first place.
And I will quote the amazing Patton Oswalt. Nobody wants to see Darth Vader as a kid.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to see Boba Fett as a kid. Nobody wants the prequels. The mystery is what's appealing about these characters. It's what makes them scary. It's what makes them cool.
We're probably not fair in talking about this because I don't know that I would have felt that way before they came out. I was not a big Star Wars fan. Ooh, my God, how could I say that? But in the mid-90s, when they were talking about doing the prequels in the first place, and of course, The Phantom Menace, before it came out, was going to be the biggest movie of all time. People insisted, and people knew it would be, and it did get fairly close to reaching Titanic numbers, but it didn't. But if I had been a huge fan, like a lot of people were, I probably would have been excited. But I think I also would have been thinking, you don't necessarily want to know the answers. I've been watching Bates Motel on Netflix for a while now. Well, I actually haven't watched it for a while now. And I think one of the reasons why I may have lost interest in it is because I don't necessarily know if I need to see what made Norman Bates Norman Bates.
Yeah, exactly.
The movie does a great job. That's why the screenplay is excellent in explaining that this guy's got incredible emotional problems. He had a very abusive mother, possibly sexually abusive. And that's why he's the kind of guy that does what he does in that movie. And in the sequels, for that matter, of the movie series. This series does well enough in the first three movies, even the first two. I mean, the third movie exactly, to explain. We don't know what Vader's all about, of course, but we know enough. And then in the end, when he has his redemptive arc, it actually makes even more sense because he comes around to being somebody who was an absolute bad guy in this movie, especially the pinnacle of that, to being somebody who, okay, well, then again, he has the Catholic ending. Tell your sister I'm sorry, and I'm sorry to you. I may have killed thousands, millions of people, but I apologize now. Okay, Catholic ending.
His last rites. It doesn't make up for the fact that he choked to death anybody who disappointed him, who failed him.
But still, I agree with you that seeing how he got to that point and having to like him for so much of those prequels, because we're supposed to, he is the hero of so many of those movies, knowing he's going to become a bad guy, it makes him not be the number three villain in the history of movies, according to the AFI. And he was on the dark side of that list. Hannibal Lecter and Norman Bates were number one and two. I think Vader could have been higher.
Mm.
But when we know where his story goes, he's not even really a villain. But then again, that may be true of Norman Bates, too, because he's somebody who's been abused, and he's nuts for that reason. As is Hannibal Lecter, and you see the prequels for him. All three of those great villains are ruined by other movies and TV shows, in the case of Psycho, I guess. We don't need to know those things about them.
Mm-hmm.
The writers are Lee Brackett and Lawrence Kasdan. Brackett did a lot of old westerns and gangster flicks, and she died of cancer before they finished doing this. Kasdan was, I think, more of a rewriter. He also worked on Return of the Jedi and some of the Indiana Jones films, and then became a director and writer in his own right. And Lucas, of course, was an executive producer on this, did not direct. And Gary Kurtz, who produced the first movie, quit after this one because he had big disputes with Lucas on what was done. I've read that Kirshner had problems with Lucas, too, but then Kirshner's on the commentary track and some of the making-of stuff, and he seems to have no problem with the guy. So whatever the reality is, Lucas was an executive, but then he was redoing the movie in his own image, and I don't really think that's a problem, because when you think about the way movies and TV shows, when they have an executive producer who has this much hand, if you go George Costanza reference, if they want to redirect or rewrite or re-edit a scene, it's their thing.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not the nice way to do things, but I get why they do.
You are performing a job for someone else, and the fact is, everybody looks at this movie and they think of George Lucas before they think of Kirshner. I had to look up his name. I'd completely forgotten who directed it. Apparently, he tried to turn it down several times, and then he told his agent about it, and his agent cajoled him into doing it.
You're going to do this.
His agent's like, are you kidding me?
Because it was the biggest movie. The first one was the biggest movie of all time.
Yeah, and his agent's just seeing dollar signs. You're not screwing me out of this commission.
But there was a dispute with Lucas and all kinds of guilds because of the opening credits. They let him get away from the first movie when he was his own director, but when he was taking away the director's credit at the beginning of the film, which was always done before, then they had that problem with it and said, you're not doing this again. So we said, oh, hell with the guilds then. And that's what's happened with Robert Rodriguez. Mm-hmm. He's quit the guilds too over the same kinds of disputes. His thing was more about Sin City, not getting to Frank Miller as a co-director. So the movie is 2.35:1. The Blu-ray is glorious looking. The first movie was too, as was Return of the Jedi, not surprisingly. Cinematographer is Peter Sushitsky, who worked on Rocky Horror Picture Show a few years before this and then became a Cronenberg guy. The editor, Paul Hirsch, also worked on the first movie, and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which we're going to cover very soon. And then George, of course, did some re-editing with his wife, Marcia, and she wasn't with him much longer. They got divorced around this time, as I recall. Of course, the music, John Williams, did all those AFI films, all the classics. And he wrote one of the most famous and iconic pieces of music in a single movie. Not so much the entire score, because it was kind of a rehash of the first movie, but the Imperial March is awesome. Mr. Burns' theme. Okay, influence, and there is a ton of it. The other movies, of course, the sequels and the prequels. The marketing, which got even bigger than it was for the first Star Wars movie. And that was a problem for Fox, because the deal that Lucas cut with them, Alan Ladd Jr., who greenlit the first movie, no one else wanted to do that, because he didn't cut a good enough deal with Lucas on this, in other words, he let him have too many rights, and then Lucas made so much more money than Fox did, really. They said, well, this is not good, Alan Ladd Jr. made all this money for us, but we're not making as much as he is. And then he said, oh, I'm out of here, and he quit. So then Lucas took Raiders of the Lost Ark to Paramount instead of taking it to Fox like he probably would have. So they cut themselves off of even more money. This movie is acknowledged as one of the best sequels ever. Does it surpass the original? We're talking about things like Godfather Part II, Aliens, some of the Lord of the Rings movies. It's in the conversation of being the best sequel ever made, along with, of course, Godfather Part II. And there are some important magazines and newspapers out there and websites and things that have said this is the best movie of all time. That's a little bit of a stretch. I think it's great, but not the best.
If you're going to talk about the most beloved movies of all time, it's pretty high up there.
like I said in a wrap-up, if you can make the Lord of the Rings one movie, Star Wars one movie, Godfather series one movie, because they are a saga, all the movies probably go up in everyone's esteem, although Godfather Part 3 ruins those to some extent, I guess, for some people. But yeah, that changes things. If you can just say the Star Wars series is the movie you have to vote on, then, okay, then you get the prequels, though, too. Okay, the awards and lists, two Oscars for the sound and for the special achievement in visual effects. So that was just given to them. They didn't have to compete for that. Only two other nominations, the sets and John Williams' music. The film made the National Film Registry in 2010. All the President's Men was put in that year, and so was The Exorcist. I just said Vader was number 3 in the Dark Side of the Heroes and Villains list. The other AFI rankings, although just nominations, it didn't make these. Top 100 Thrills, probably should have made that, but yeah. Okay. And then two Top 100 Quotes that failed to make it. How did this not make it? I am your father.
How did that not make it?
It did not. Nor did another very famous one, one of the Yoda's quotes. Try not. Do or do not. There is no try.
I can't believe neither of those quotes made it.
Yeah.
There are so many terrible quotes on the quotes list.
Well, more importantly, quotes that people never actually say.
Yeah, people say, Luke, I'm your father, on a daily basis, I hear that quoted.
Or at least some kind of reference to it, and that should be the point of famous quotes. Okay, well, obviously I fanboyed myself through this a little bit. And speaking of fanboys, I probably should have said this off the top. A tribute to Jeff Waugh, whose birthday was just last week. The poor guy died of cancer not that long ago. We mentioned him on one of the podcasts because it had just happened. And he was a fan of our podcast, an old friend of mine. He was a fan of Star Wars and wanted us to do it months before we ever got to it. Years before, because he wanted us to do it back when we were in the 40s. I had to tell him more than once, we're doing these chronologically, man. We'll just do it eventually. But he wanted it now. So a tribute to him. Great guy. And I know that this past week on Facebook, and we're recording this before we get to the week before this podcast drops, but I know that Facebook will be loaded with people saying great things about him as his birthday comes up. So parting thoughts on The Empire Strikes Back.
I guess my one parting thought would be respect to the fanboys, to the fans that like this movie best, and I wish that Hollywood would pay attention to that and pay attention to what makes Empire stand out from the other Star Wars films, because it is a darker, more thoughtful, more character-driven film that takes risks and surprises the audience over and over and does not follow a formula, but still does a lot of things right. I wish that was what Hollywood paid attention to when they were trying to replicate this, because it truly is the best Star Wars movie.
And it didn't just remake the first movie. It's a whole different story. It's a continuation of what we already saw from before. And of course, as I've already said, if you didn't see the first or the third at the time, you'd be lost, which is what it should be when it's a series. You shouldn't necessarily be seeing the exact same thing all over again. We both like The Force Awakens a lot, but it is playing up a ton of what we saw in Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi.
It's definitely time for them to start parting from the formula and giving us something new and surprising. If they do that, audiences will be loyal forever. We really need to be surprised and impressed.
You said dark a minute ago when it comes to sequels, action movies, that kind of thing. By the time this podcast drops, we're right around the time of Captain America: Civil War, when Iron Man and Captain America are going to become enemies. I think that'll be resolved by the end of that movie because they have to fight some galactic thing against Thanos and the Civil War series they're going to do. They're playing that off the comics. But that's a dark angle to take, too, that these guys are actually fighting each other. They're not fighting these incredible threats they constantly have to face off against. Now, that isn't what we see in this movie, but the idea that it can get darker and worse. Well, I mentioned Godfather Part 2. We don't necessarily need or want to see the mob people survive, but then they're the characters we spend time with, so we have to care about them a huge amount. But then in the second movie, look what Michael does. He alienates his entire family. And in this film, of course, Empire Strikes Back, we see the Empire, Vader especially, just beating the living crap out of all the good guys.
Oh, yeah.
So it's a pretty good legacy, and maybe Civil War, the Captain America movie, will continue on with that notion of, let's show things at their darkest moment because people want to see that. And in the end, they'll rise up, and then they'll win.
Mm-hmm.
We know that's going to come in these kinds of films. In the end, good is going to win out. So, in a week, on the next 100 project, we veer into the land of laughs, and we get way back into the 40s again. We talked about it plenty on the Top 100 project when we reviewed Bringing Up Baby. It's Howard Hawks' His Girl Friday. The coming attractions trivia for His Girl Friday. How many of Cary Grant's 8 movies that made the AFI's Top 100 Laughs list were in the top 30? And this is not a trick question. It isn't 0, and it isn't 1.
Okay, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, rate us, review us, it helps people find us. And you can also check out the almost 160...
Something like that. Something. Including, of course, Star Wars, which is
yes,
down there.
Yes, yes, yeah. Including Star Wars and all the films that ever made the AFI's top 100 list in 98 or 2007, all 123 titles. All of our podcasts are available on iTunes, so please go
for
check
free.
It out for free.
Not like Marin, you gotta pay for the back issues. Successful jerk that he is.
Who does he think he is? You can find both Ryan and me on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. We would like to warmly thank our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com.
I still love you.
I still know.
End the podcast. End the podcast right now.
And cut.